He couldn't remember ever having seen her off the bridge before. What is it? An occultation, she answered. A what? On the approach path, there may be another Rick's ship. Executive officer. Hobbs could see how they had missed it for so long. No drive signature, no easy graviton emissions, no active sensors of its own. Even now, all they had was an occultation, a milliseconds-long dimming of a few background stars. Whatever it was, the object was invisible to transluminal sensors and was too far away for the Lynx's active sensors to tell them very much. But it was big. At least 50 kilometers across, Ensign Tyre repeated. It's a spare receiver array, Engineer Frick said. An extra folded down and trailing the battlecruiser. Why so far behind? Hobbs asked. The object was too distant from the battlecruiser for an easy rendezvous. As it was, the Lynx could easily reach it before the larger Rick's ship. Perhaps they wanted to keep it invisible, the captain said. It's running absolutely silent. If it weren't so damn big, we'd have missed it. And if the captain hadn't been so paranoid, Hobbs thought, they'd have missed it at any size. The last thing anyone else had expected was another Rick's vessel coming into the system. It's not necessarily running silent, sir, Tyre softly added. It could simply be inert matter. When will we know its mass? Zai asked. Tyre looked into the air. The master pilot's drone should be within range to tell us that in 14 minutes. Hobbs looked across the table at Marks and wished again that the captain hadn't insisted on waking the master pilot in mid-sleep sequence. The man looked exhausted, his drowsy absence of mind animated with a bad case of the shakes. All his piloting skill would be meaningless if he couldn't think straight. The recon drone had been launched almost immediately after the first occultation had been spotted. The drone launch rail was useless, unable to give the drone a magnetic shove, so they'd had to launch it at zero relative. The craft was the Lynx's last surviving fast recon drone and could sustain 600 Gs for an hour. It had already turned over and was close to matching velocities with the object. The drone was under automation now, but the captain wanted Marks at the controls when it made its approach. "Don't lose that craft, Marks," Hobbs said. "We're short enough on drones as it is." Marks rubbed his eyes. "No, Exo Hobbs. But I'd better get to my canopy." He rose slowly. "Sir," he added shakily, giving a small bow to the captain before he left the command bridge. When the master pilot was gone, Gunner Wilson spoke. "Sir, it can't be a warship. It's too big. It would dwarf anything we've seen from the Ricks before." "It's bigger than a Laxu colony ship," Hobbs said, "and that's the biggest powered craft the Empire's ever encountered." "It might be nothing," Captain Zai admitted. "Part of a light sail from their original acceleration, even a section of the receiver array, something that was damaged and removed years ago." Hobbs nodded. "It could be a planetoid, for that matter, its course purely coincidental, but that seemed unlikely." The object's approach course almost perfectly bisected those of the battlecruiser and the assault ship that had attacked the Empress Palace. Whatever it was, the object had to be Rick's. Commando. Herd felt a tapping on her face. She pulled off the hood of the ablative suit and raised her head above the surface, shaking snow from her head. The repeater that had summoned her scuttled away as she sat up. The cold had thoroughly penetrated her body. Rick's commandos felt pain, but rarely longer than was necessary for their bodies to deliver a warning. After the long fall through frigid air and the hours buried in the snow, however, Herd felt ice and agony in every muscle. The cuts on her face had scarred, and her broken nose felt bloated. Even her hypercarbon joints were stiff. She let her body temperature rise. An increase in heat would return some of her flexibility. The Imperial's thermal images might find her more easily, but her whereabouts would be obvious soon enough. The summons from the little repeater meant that Alexander was only a few minutes from effecting its takeover of the entanglement facility. Therefore, Herd was about to be rescued. A host of small craft under the compound mine's control waited on the other side of the wire, ready to assist in her extraction. The commando's rescue wasn't a humanitarian gesture on Alexander's part, however. Her exit would merely be a diversion. So, the messier the better. The repeater scuttled away as she stretched her muscles. The path the small machine took indicated the direction from which the attack would come. Herd moved after it, again crawling with an interrupted gait to conceal herself from motion sensors. But she moved faster now, a little carelessly. Alexander wanted the Imperials to respond to her departure with main force to distract them from the movements of the repeaters. The propagation of the compound mind's control was now entering a critical stage. Over the last 6 hours, the Gospel of Alexander had spread among the repeaters, each convert adding another to the fold every few minutes. As in any geometric progression, the number of repeaters controlled by Alexander was arcing upward dramatically. Very soon, more than half of the repeater colony would be in motion. Even the Imperials were apt to realize that something was up, unless something dramatic occupied their attention. Suddenly, shooting stars appeared on the horizon before Herd. Arcs of light reached into the sky. Flashes emanating from just below the horizon showed where landmines were detonating. Concussions and the ripping howls of autocannon followed almost 20 seconds later. The wire was 4 kilometers away. Herd stood and began running toward the wire, headed straight for the conflagration. A surge of joy filled her. This was the most dangerous part of the mission, but it was good to finally stretch her legs. The sky came alive, each luminous missile distinct in the cold, clear air. The wire had come under attack by Alexander's ragtag armada, a mob of automated flying machines, weather dirigibles, bird migration monitors, crowd effect crop dusters, solar reflector kites. All of Legis's air traffic spotters had disappeared from their stations a few days before, and the small percentage that had survived the perilous trip to the Arctic were also in the attacking host. A few dislodged environmental satellites arced across the sky to crash into hull-alloy armored emplacements. Even a handful of walking and flying toys that Herd had salvaged from aircraft luggage joined in, feinting to draw fire from the wire's guns and sacrificing themselves to trip booby traps, monofilament snares, and landmines. The motley flotilla posed little danger to the facility, of course. Very few of the vehicles assaulting the wire were a match for even a single militia soldier. But the Imperial defenses were set to maximum response, alert for any attack on the facility since Rana Harta's escape with Herd. The wire's arsenal was pouring thousands of heavy metal rounds per minute into kites made of mylar, launching missiles the size of air cars at weather balloons, expending cluster mines on children's toys. Herd ran toward the melee, pulling her Rix blaster from her mission pack. She'd hardly used the weapon since the firefight in the palace, conserving its powerful charges for when she would need them most. The recon flyer was on the other side of the wire, under Alexander's control and waiting for the defenses to exhaust themselves against their figmentary attackers. The wire was designed to deliver a short, punishing blow, delaying an enemy until reinforcements arrived. Its supplies of ordnance were limited. Herd's scanner set up a wail. She swept it across the horizon to locate the first of these reinforcements on their way, a pair of ground-effect vehicles racing toward her from the central barracks of the facility. The commando changed direction, running parallel to the wire now. For this first trap to work, she had to get to the far side of the snowdrift landing zone. Herd reduced her blaster to a diversionary power setting and dropped to a firing position. She took aim and fired a long stream of random photons at the GEVs, the blaster sweeping across the EM spectrum to suggest a wide array of weapons. She checked the scanner. The hovercraft spotted her and changed course, angling toward her. More vehicle signatures appeared behind them on her scanner. It was working. The Imperials thought that she had come through the embattled wire. Believing that the attacking force had penetrated the terrific fire zones of the perimeter, they would be worried. Herd's sharp eyes now caught a flicker of light from another sector of the facility. Another, smaller contingent of Alexander's conscript army was attacking the wire from a new direction. Overall, Alexander had committed 4 separate groups to divide the defenders' resources. The other 3 were utterly insignificant, but perhaps the Imperials would outthink themselves and assume that the true attack was a feint. The GEVs were closing on her now, bearing down from the other side of the landing zone. The scream of their jet turbines drowned out even the battle at the wire. The commando cycled her blaster to a combat setting in case one made it past the trap. She could see them now, their approach raising a cloud of snow. She dropped to the tundra as one of the hovercraft opened fire, the ripping sound of an autocannon reaching her ears as a line of snow and earth before her lifted in a rolling wave. Then the GEVs reached the landing zone. The permanent tundral snowdrift that filled the trench was usually as dense as concrete, but the heavy vehicles were in for a surprise. The GEVs hit the doped snow at 300 clicks and dropped through the thin crust of frost like charging predators through the leaves and branches of a tiger pit. The nanoed snow foam probably slowed them a bit, but their armored mass and huge speed packed thousands of times the kinetic energy of a human at terminal velocity. As the hovercraft arced downward, their turbans spewed the treacherous white foam out from their entry holes in geysers. The shockwave of their collision with the trench's rocky side reached Herd a few seconds later. The impact threw a fist of earth up into her face, reopening her scarred eyebrow and treating her broken nose to a second round of agony. A gout of flame burst from the trench, a huge cloud of foam snow rising up like the spray of some vast breaking wave. Wiping blood from her eyes, the commando fired her blaster twice through the cloud. She wanted the Imperials to think, for the next few minutes anyway, that enemy fire rather than mishap had taken out the GEVs. The commando checked her scanner. The second formation of hovercraft was wheeling to one side now, circumspect after their compatriots' sudden destruction. The smaller returns of a few Imperial remotes moved into view, and Herd cycled her blaster down to a sniper's setting, low power, high accuracy, in case one got too close. But she figured that she'd bought herself a few needed minutes. Herd turned and ran toward the wire again. The firefight there was dying down. That meant either that the Imperials' ammunition was running low or that the attacking force had been decimated. She hoped it was the former. Her scanner showed the recon flyer still waiting out of harm's way. As Herd neared the wire, an autocannon emplacement acquired her and fired. She dropped and skidded through the snow, cycling her blaster back up. Rolling into firing position, she destroyed the emplacement with a single shot. As she passed another cannon, an arc of tracers came Herd's way, but she silenced that gun with equal ease. The wire suffered from a typical flaw. It was designed to keep attackers out, not in. Most of its firepower was oriented outward. The main dangers to Herd were landmines and monofilament snares, single-molecule tripwires that would slice through her hypercarbon bones like a knife through water. But this was no time to consider the dangers before her. The remaining Imperial GEVs would regain their confidence soon enough. The commando plunged forward. Every few steps she fired her blaster toward the ground 100 meters in front of her. The full-force plasma rounds rocked the tundra, sending up gouts of flame as if she were following in the footsteps of some huge demon, fiery and invisible. Landmines were detonated by the shockwaves, and autocannon imaged the boiling plasma plumes and fired at them instead of Herd. Bright lines of monofilament in her path glowed for a moment as they were incinerated. Shrapnel and flying debris cut the Rixwoman's face and tore at the ablative suit. Her boots were melted by the superheated earth of the plasma craters. Even her flexile metal soles burned. One of the autocannon emplacements found her and put a flechette through her thigh before she blasted it. Her weapon set up a two-pitched keening alarm. It was simultaneously overheating and running out of ammo. Another flechette struck her and Herd stumbled. She went to ground in a deep crater where her blaster had made a direct hit on a landmine. The red-hot floor of the hole burned her hands, the heat forcing her eyes closed. The sharp smell of her own hair igniting filled her nostrils. Herd's burned fingers fumbled for the positioning device. Had she penetrated far enough through the wire for the recon flyer to reach her? She forced her eyes open and stared at the device. In the Hadean light of the crater, she saw that the readout had melted. She kneeled with blistered hands protecting her face, her hypercarbon kneecaps against the molten earth. She felt nothing. Pain overrides had terminated all sensation from her skin. It occurred to the commando that she had spent the last few hours besieged by freezing cold, and now she was burning to death. Then she heard a turbine jet approaching, the whine of an Imperial GEV, not the recon flyer. She turned and raised her blaster, peering through the mirage-like veil of superheated air. A hovercraft was headed for her, approaching slowly so that the wire's friend or foe sensors wouldn't confuse it with an enemy. The GEV moved in a search pattern. They couldn't detect her amid the chaos. She aimed the blaster and pressed its firing stud. Nothing happened. The weapon's heat sink panel glowed white, unable to disperse enough energy to recycle the blaster in the boiling crater. The hovercraft wandered closer to her. Close enough. The commando pushed two blistered fingers into her blaster's suicide triggers and pulled them simultaneously. Then she heaved the blaster over the side of the crater and it spun through the air toward the GEV. Herd dropped flat as answering fire erupted from the hovercraft. The hot lance of a flechette passing through her stomach grimly complemented the scalding rock of the crater floor. Seconds later, the GEV's chattering autocannon was silenced by the explosion of the blaster. A sheet of plasma passed over the crater, sucking the air upward from around Herd with a whoosh, momentarily snuffing the small fires in the hole. When she could hear again, the turbine of the GEV was howling like a wounded animal, dopplering as the machine retreated. She struggled to her knees again. The ablative suit was mostly gone now. What remained of it was burned onto her skin in patches. Her tactile sense was so suppressed by pain overrides that it was hard to keep her balance. The flexile metal that protected her soles had lost all elasticity, rigidified and cracked by the heat. Hurd peered across the tundra at the retreating GEV. It bounced backward, bobbing on its air cushion like some toy on a string. The armor glowed white hot. She wondered if the crew inside were even alive, or was the thing simply on autopilot, reeling blindly from the blaster's shockwave. Her vision was blurred, her eyes dry and slitted in the heat. But Hurd could see two more ground-effect vehicles in the distance approaching cautiously. She searched the metalled plastic of her mission pack. There were hissing and useless smoke grenades, a ruined remote drone, and a silent dart gun whose Rixian curves were bent into an ugly mess. Nothing that could scratch an armored vehicle. The commando drew her monofilament knife and stumbled to her feet. The GEVs were circling a few kilometers away, afraid to close with her. The explosions from the wire behind Hurd had settled. Suddenly, the commando felt the tingle of static electricity. Then a rush of air filled the crater, sparking the glowing rocks into open flame like a strong wind against embers. It was the recon flyer descending. Hurd realized that her hearing must be woefully damaged. The noisy craft had sneaked up on her. One of the GEVs opened fire and the recon flyer responded. Its small cannon whined in a pitiful sound, but the Imperial craft pulled back, wary after the Rix blaster's terrific self-destruct. The recon flyer bounced on its air cushion just above Hurd, whipping the air in the crater into a frenzy. The commando reached up and grabbed one of the landing struts, and the flyer soared up and out of the crater. In 10 seconds, they were 100 meters aloft and climbing. Dangling from the craft with locked muscles, she looked down at the wreckage of the wire. A swathe of destruction cut through it. Her neat row of blaster scars extending from the inside outward, and a hodgepodge of landmine craters, crashed aircraft, and friendly fire damage marking Alexander's attack from without. The two paths of ruin met halfway, leaving the wire utterly ruptured. Only a few bright lances of anti-aircraft tracers survived to dog the flyer as it rose, too far away and firing in short bursts to conserve their waning ammunition. Hurd realized that she would pass out soon and didn't trust the muscles in her burned hands to stay locked, so she climbed laboriously over the side of the flyer and collapsed into the gunner's webbing. "Take me to Rana Hata," she commanded her god, and lost consciousness. Compound Mind. Alexander was ready. Across the planet Legis 15, a sudden pall of electronic failures struck. The telephonic system dropped 250 million conversations, air cars tossed their drivers into manual, and inside market trader heads-ups, the cool icons of commerce were replaced with polychromatic sheet lightning. Every remote surgeon, engineer, and hand-eye gamer was paralyzed as secondary sight and hearing stuttered, then flew into a rage. Air screens, false views, and overlays were replaced with a riot of color, a turbulent river of passing data in its rawest form. At the operational centers of the planet, the air traffic hub, the private currency exchange, the infoterrorism militia's distributed HQ, Legis' administrators gaped as their soccer-field-sized air screens tumbled into snow crash. For a moment, the frantic operators were blind. Then they booted the large flat hard screens put in place for some unthinkable emergency such as this. The backups returned a bizarre sight, oddly similar from all perspectives, whether civilian, commercial, or military. The infrastructure surged like a living thing. As one, the planet's vast channels of information distended, pushed, were seized by a vast peristaltic motion that had a single focus. Alexander swept toward the entanglement facility repeater array, a geyser powered by the pressures of an ocean. A few 100 million Legisites stared in surprise at the hard screens of their wailing phones and saw interplanetary access codes. Worried that pirates had hijacked their accounts, a few million of them stabbed cutoff switches or popped out batteries. But their phones stayed connected, powered by microwave pulses from borrowed traffic transponders. Police and militia radios squawked like ancient modems. The repair gremlins in air cars and cooling units, usually silent unless their machines were ailing, arose as one to flood their reserved frequencies. Every fiber hardline on the planet was lit to capacity. even medical endoframes, the tiny monitors that watched arrhythmic hearts and trick knees, employed their transmitters, lending their reserved emergency bandwidth to the flow of data toward the pole. Alexander took everything. The planet's transmission resources focused northward, data converging on a billion channels like some vast delta flowing in reverse, and the compound mind sent itself. The mind crammed into the hostage repeaters spread across the tundra, invaded the big dishes devoted to interplanetary transmission. Alexander didn't bother with the entanglement grid itself, but grabbed the transmitters that linked 15 with Legius's other inhabited planets. A few militia specialists saw what was happening, realized that the polar facility had been taken over and was blaring at the sky with fantastic throughput. But their software commands were ignored, the manual cutoffs useless. The specialists tried to explain the situation to the base's commanders, sending priority messages on the precious few hardlines in the comms system. To maintain the interplanetary blackout, they said, drastic action would have to be taken. Carpet bomb the repeaters. Destroy the dishes. Only a few minutes remained to act. But the attention of those in charge was fully engaged. A battle raged along the wire, an incoming fleet of aircraft, a deluge of rockets and drones. And apparently, a Rix commando, the Rix commando, was somewhere inside the wire. This was a main force assault. The existence of the facility was in peril. There was no time to listen to the wild pronouncements of a few hysterical comm techs. In the confusion, Alexander was able to shoot into the sky. The compound mind found that space was cold. It was chilled by the absence of Legius's million transactions per second. Self-awareness began to dim as the mind was spread into a spaghetti-thin stream, like a human pulled into a black hole. Behind Alexander was the screaming planet, its infrastructure ruptured as the compound mind tore itself free, a possessing demon leaving the fevered body of its victim. Forward was the icy mind lock of pure transmission, a descent into suspended animation as the mind's data stream crossed space, searching for its promised target. The torrent of information poured through the funnel of the array, leaving a reeling world behind. And for 850 timeless minutes, Alexander knew nothing. Master Pilot. Master Pilot Mark struggled to concentrate. He'd never been yanked out of the middle of a hypersleep cycle before. It was more confusing than planetary day-length adaptation, worse than long-term heavy G's. Mark had been trained to resist the five different symptoms of exhaustion, to orient without gravity cues, to drink air and inject food. But he'd never been drilled in this particular insult to the body. No one at Imperial Pilot School had ever thought to wake him up from the midst of deep deltas. Only Captain Laurent Zai had proven so perverse. Marx took his hands from the drone's controls and cupped his eyes in his palms, grabbing a few seconds of blackness to salve his primary sight. But the object was still visible in synesthesia, its bizarre undulations worsening his disorientation. He pushed his sensor sub-drones out a bit farther for better parallax, trying to grasp the enormity of the Rix thing. But increased perspective only made it worse, made it more real. The whole bridge staff and all of data analysis were watching over his shoulder. Their hushed voices were filled with awe, so Marx knew he wasn't completely crazy, but he still didn't believe his second sight. The object looked like an ocean, an uninterrupted boloid ocean without benefit of exposed landmass or iron core. More than 100 clicks across, at its widest point it spun like a champagne dervish. Almost everyone in the Navy had attempted the trick at some point. In drunken zero-G, pop a bottle of sparkling wine, catching the unavoidable ejected froth in one hand. Use a straw or a pair of eating sticks to prod and coax, to herd the fizzing liquid into a stable, spinning, free-fall globule. Pulsating and twisting like a liquid tornado, each champagne dervish had its own personality, its own Rorschach symmetry of stability. Cheap, sweet champagne was the best, with its slightly stickier surface tension, and if cheap stuff wound up splattered across the room, at least the financial damage would be limited. But the giant thing assaulting Marx's sensibilities wasn't composed of wine. It wasn't properly liquid at all. The megaton mass readings and chromographs indicated that it was mostly composed of silicon. The moving wavelets that propagated across its surface suggested the arciform shapes of dunes, as if the object were a huge floating desert brushed by ethereal winds. But the thing had no atmosphere. Data analysis had told Marx that the dune movement was caused by internal motion. There must be wild currents and stormlets inside. The whole thing was spinning around itself, a quasi-liquid planetoid, a wobbling gyroscope, a champagne dervish of dry sand. Master Pilot Mark sent a tiny probe toward the object. His drone was configured for leisurely, unarmed recon and had a considerable number of sub-probes. Unless the object decided to take a shot at him, Marks could easily keep his main craft out of danger. The thing didn't seem to have weapons or a drive. Data analysis said it was completely undifferentiated, desert through and through. But what the hell was it for? The unidentified object had come in on the same path as the Rix battlecruiser, moving along at almost the same velocity. It had a far greater mass than any ship, though. Some very powerful drive must have accelerated it and slowed it down again. Otherwise, its trip here from Rix space would make it very ancient indeed. Marx's probe struck the object softly, sending up a splash, a raindrop in a puddle. A few droplets from the impact trailed away from the object, their bond of surface tension broken, and Marx assigned another pilot to maneuver one of his satellite drones in pursuit of the wayward sand stuff. Actual spore from the beast would be helpful. The master pilot turned his attention to the readings from inside the thing. The probe tumbled helplessly in the interior currents, spun by a thousand minor eddies, carried in a greater circle by the Coriolis force of the object's overall rotation. Sampling data came back. The object was indeed mostly silicon, but in some sort of bizarrely complex granular structure, and it was hot inside the whirling desert. As the probe was drawn into its center, spiraling inward like a floating speck down a bathtub drain, the temperature climbed. That didn't make sense. The thing was hard vacuum cold on the outside and showed no evidence of internal radiation. It wasn't nearly dense enough for gravitational compression, and the friction from the eddies of sand shouldn't be as hot as the readings Marx was getting. He concluded that some sort of power source was working inside. Before it was a quarter of the way to the core, the probe's faint signal was swallowed by heat noise and the object's inherent density. "Moving in closer," Marx said. He brought his sub-drones into position surrounding the object. He split his second and tertiary sight among the various viewpoints of his entourage, forming a single image composed of every angle. The exercise addled his brain for a moment as the overlays of shifting sands twisted in a moving moiré. Marx increased his view's resolution, sending spiderwebs of sensory filaments out from each of the sub-drones for maximum reception. Although the Lynx's processors were still damaged, the master pilot had priority. Without an entire battle to run, the frigate's surviving columns of silicon and phosphorus were still quite formidable. Soon, the master pilot's vision became comprehensible, meshing like the frames of a stereograph when the eyes align. Now Marx could really see the shape of the object, began to feel the period and flow of the sandy ocean. The dune's motion was similar to the roiling clouds of smoke he watched through his microscope when he studied air currents for small craft flight. Marx let his mind relax, almost drifting back into the dream state from which Hobbes had so harshly yanked him. He reveled in the patterns of the sand ocean, and unconsciously guided his various craft about the object, drinking in its form. There was something seductive in the fluid mathematics of the thing. The master pilot's tired mind began to grasp it. Suddenly, the overlaid images stuttered, then multiplied before Marx's eyes. The flexing of dunes increased in speed, their dance accelerating madly. A barrage of new colors played across the sands, filled the master pilot's three levels of vision with a cascade of lightning that flashed across the spectrum. Pictures formed, piling onto each other in a way that should have been simply noise. But somehow he could simultaneously comprehend images of countless faces, window vistas, data icons, security cams. His secondary hearing blared with the chatter of a million conversations, confessions, jokes, dramas. It was synesthesia gone mad. Instead of three, Marx had 100 levels of sight, each discernible as a separate view. It felt as if a whole world were being shoved through his mind. He reached for the cutoff, but his hand froze, his mind crammed too full to react. The layers of synesthesia began rolling across each other, commingling as did the dunes of the object below. Sight and sound collapsed into a single torrent, pulled themselves apart to address eye and ear again, and finally tattered like a flag driven down the throat of a tempest, unraveling into a thousand separate threads. Dimly, Joachim Marx heard distant voices from the Lynx's bridge questioning him, then shouting, then issuing sharp and harried commands. But he couldn't understand the language they spoke. It seemed like a tongue dredged up from childhood memories, the sounds put back together in random order. He vaguely heard his own name. But by then he was far off in yet another dream, vast and furious. Executive officer. What the hell happened to him? Medical doesn't know yet, sir. What about the scouts?